If you are not experiencing one of these three kinds of suffering, I promise you that there are people around you who are. So let me just list these three for you. First, there's a disappointment that comes and a suffering that comes through relationships. Perhaps you had a romantic attachment, high hopes for a romance with a particular person, but those hopes were not fulfilled and you were broken. You were hurt by that. Perhaps you had a marriage and you tried to hold it together, but you were not able to do it. Or perhaps you're trying right now to hold a marriage together, but it's hard. And day after day, through frustration, you feel so alone and so disappointed. There are others of you here who have a parent, or perhaps a child, who disappointed you deeply. Often, it's in the closest relationships of life that we hurt each other most. So, maybe you haven't suffered in relationships, but then perhaps you may have suffered through despair because of dreams that did not come true. You had your heart set on a certain college and you weren't accepted. You've been preparing for years for a particular career and doors to that career were closed. You had a dream job that you enjoyed and were looking forward to for your future. And for whatever reason, you lost that job. You were sure that you were the person appropriate for that promotion and it went to someone else. You worked so hard to be financially secure, and then it happened, whatever it was. Again, if you haven't suffered through disappointment in relationships or through despair because of dreams that did not come true, perhaps you've suffered disaster of one kind or another. The death of a loved one. This past week, the Wong family in our congregation lost their patriarch, Mr. Pao T. Wong, went to be with the Lord this week. He was baptized here a year and a half ago, and it was God's grace that at the end his children were around him, and he went to be with the Lord in confidence from his deathbed. Some of you had friends who died at the World Trade Center 7 years ago, as I do. Some of you have friends who lost a spouse at the World Trade Center 7 years ago, as I do. So by whatever means, suffering does come, sooner or later, to every one of us. So as I said at the outset, suffering is one of the unhappy realities of this life, and no reasonable person is going to deny that. And that takes us to our scripture today, because it's in the book of Job, a man who suffered perhaps as much as it's possible for a man to suffer, that we get help and perspective on suffering in particular and on life in general. So let's turn to the book of Job in your Bibles if you have them, and if not, we'll turn to the bulletin where we have 1 and 2 printed in the text. Let's stand out of respect for God's Word as we turn to Job 1 and 2. This is a longer portion, and I just ask your patience in advance. But it's kind of it's exciting, it's fast-moving, and it also sets the stage for everything we're going to be doing in the next 7 weeks. So follow along as I read. In the land of Uz there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters. And he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys. And he had a large number of servants. Job was the greatest man among all the people of the East. His sons used to take turns holding feasts in their homes, and they would invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When a period of feasting had run its course, Job would send and have them purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, "Perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." This was Job's regular custom. One day the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming through the earth and going back and forth in it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." "Does Job fear God for nothing?" Satan replied. "Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You have blessed the work of his hands, so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, everything he has is in your hands. But on the man himself, do not lay a finger." Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. One day when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys were grazing nearby, and the Sabaeans attacked and carried them off. They put the servants to the Lord, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The fire of God fell from the sky and burned up the sheep and the servants, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The Chaldeans formed 3 raiding parties and swept down on your camels and carried them off. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, yet another messenger came and said, "Your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, when suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert and struck the 4 corners of the house. It collapsed on them, and they are dead. And I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head. Then he fell to the ground in worship, and said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. On another day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them to present himself before him. And the Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming through the earth and going back and forth in it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. And he still maintains his integrity, though you incited me against him to ruin him without any reason." "Skin for skin," Satan replied, "a man will give all he has for his own life. But stretch out your hand and strike his flesh and bones, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, he is in your hands, but you must spare his life." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and afflicted Job with painful sores from the soles of his feet to the top of his head. Then Job took a piece of broken pottery and scraped himself with it as he sat among the ashes. His wife said to him, "Are you still holding on to your integrity? Curse God and die." He replied, "You are talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble?" In all this, Job did not sin in what he said. When Job's 3 friends, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, heard about all the troubles that had come upon him, then set out from their homes and met together by agreement to go and sympathize with him and comfort him. When they saw him from a distance, they could hardly recognize him. They began to weep aloud. They tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads. And they sat on the ground with him for 7 days and 7 nights. No one said a word to him because they saw how great his suffering was. Today we've read at some length chapters 1 and 2 because all of the key characters for the next 40 chapters of the book of Job are introduced already. You've got the whole foundation now, and what we're going to do is look more deeply at different characters and the things they say and do and what kind of answers we can find from this powerful, powerful text. There are 5 scenes in chapters 1 and 2 that we're going to look at. Number 1, who is Job? Very briefly, who wrote Job and what's it about? You know, when we suffer, the most common question we ask is, why? Why me? Why now? Why this? Why? Why? No portion of Scripture, No text in ancient or modern literature addresses the question of why with more thoughtfulness, more honesty, more surgical precision than the book of Job. The theological term for this is a theodicy. How can a good and just God allow evil, particularly for those who love Him most? Job is an epic poem. It faces the problem of suffering with emotional integrity and spiritual wisdom. You're going to hear Job wail in the weeks to come. He's a good man, righteous man, blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil, verse 2. The greatest man, verse 3, among all the peoples of the East. And Job, God allows Job to suffer deeply. Why? The emotions just well up inside him. And we'll see. What kind of man was Job? We don't know who wrote the book of Job. We don't know when it was written or where. We do know from the language and cultural references that this is a very ancient text. Possibly around the 10th century BC, around the time of Solomon, but also possibly earlier than that. The book raises issues that are timeless. We don't know who wrote this book, and we don't know when. But we do know that the issues in this book, every thoughtful person who believes in God, or even who doesn't, will ask these questions or turn these questions over in their mind at some point in their life. And Job takes us deeper on these questions than anybody else. Job is a very wealthy man, a very good man. He was devoted to his family. His children were devoted to each other. It's interesting, the seven sons alternated. Each one took a day of the week and had the feast at his house. And just to show their sort of sibling affection, their sisters were always invited. So it was all 10 of them. Every night, somebody's house, the guys hosted and the ladies came, and it was just family night at Job's children's. And then he was concerned for them. He would regularly, after the feast was over weekly, he would make a sacrifice to God. Maybe my children have sinned against God and offended Him, and God, please forgive them. When it says that Job was blameless and upright, it doesn't mean that he never sinned. It means that he knew that he and his family did sin, and he knew that he needed to turn regularly to God and offer sacrifices so that God would forgive him and them. So, scene one, Job was a very good man. He was prosperous. Job was a God-centered man. Chiefly, we have to see, Job was a God-centered man. Second scene, the throne room of heaven dialogue in verses 6 to 12. Angels come to present themselves before God. Satan comes also, a Judas in the midst of the disciples. The word Satan means adversary. He is the ultimate power for spiritual evil in the universe. God says to Satan, this is so stunning. God says to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? Who starts all of this? Job fears me. He does what is right. Satan is cynical. He's only motivated by self-interest. He doesn't love and respect you. He knows that you give him material benefits, wealth, health, a large and happy family. Satan's point is this. I turned Adam in the garden. In fact, all these people who claim to love and honor you, all these people can be turned. I can flip them all. I offer wealth. I offer power. I strike their lives. I can flip them all. I take them up. I take them down. I flip them. So don't you think, God, that these people love you? Don't think they respect you, because I can flip every one of them. He tried to turn Jesus with wealth and power. He tried to destroy Peter and Paul with suffering. What's he doing in your life? What's he doing in mine? Satan's agenda is simple: to destroy and ridicule the bond between God and his people. Job is the early and the great example of Satan's work through suffering. God says, all right, he's in your hands, but whatever else you do, don't lay a finger on Job himself. Scene 3. Job falls into Satan's hands, his property and his family, verse 13 to 22. Satan goes out and in four stunning strokes, he destroys almost everything that Job has, his wealth and his children, all dead. But Job's response is remarkable. He doesn't fall for Satan's bait, not yet at least, he doesn't flip. He trusts God, he praises God. Verse 21 and 22, we read, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised. C.S. Lewis, an Oxford professor and atheist who became a Christian, wrote a book called The Screwtape Letters. And The Screwtape Letters is counsel from a more mature devil to an apprentice devil on how to flip humans, how to take them away from God. And so the devil Screwtape says to his younger mentee, he says, and it's in your outline, our cause is never more in danger than when a human no longer desiring, but still intending to do our enemy's will, our enemy from the perspective of the devil is God, no longer desiring to do God's will, but still intending, looks around upon a universe from which every trace of God seems to have vanished, and asks why he has been forsaken, and still obeys. Satan's cause is never more in danger than when that happens. That's Job. He seems forsaken, but he obeys. Fourth, more dialogue in heaven. God points out Job to Satan again. God says that Job still fears him and shuns evil. And then there's something very, very important at the end of verse 3 that you need to see for the next few weeks to make any sense. God says to Satan at the end of verse 3, chapter 2, you incited me against him for no reason. Those three words are critical. God says, this man is innocent. This man did not deserve chastisement. You incited me against him for no reason. As the book of Job unfolds, we need to keep that in mind. But again, Satan says, it's still just self-interest. You haven't allowed me to hit him where they all really live. I'm touching his things, I'm touching his relatives, but let me touch him. And then you'll see him flip. You haven't let me touch his health. And God replies in chapter 2, verse 6, very well then, he is in your hands, but you must spare his life. Scene 5. Job in Satan's hands again, physical suffering this time. So Satan goes out and strikes Job with boils. This is the last straw. Only death could take Job lower than he is now. Let's read chapter 2, 7 and 8. Why don't you follow along with me? Let's read together. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and afflicted Job with painful sores from the soles of his feet to the top of his head. Let's read verse 8 together. Then Job took a piece of broken pottery and scraped himself with it as he sat among the ashes. Job has gone from a position of wealth and honor and power in his community, see verse 3 of chapter 1, the greatest man among all the peoples in the east, of the east, to poverty, pathetic weakness. Here he is in the ashes, scraping himself with some broken glass. Ugliness. His friends in verse 12 see him and they don't even recognize him. He's so afflicted. And shame. He's a broken man. Everything that he had is now gone. His wife says to him, you're obviously through now. Curse God and die. She writes him off. Never a good idea with God's children. Job is going to come back very well, as we will see. But Job's wife, we never hear about her again. Three lessons from this story. First of all, my relationship with God will include suffering. My relationship with God will include suffering. Perhaps some of you have seen Fiddler on the Roof, and Tevye, the dad, says, looks up to the sky and says, I know, we are your chosen people. But once in a while, can't you choose someone else? There's an election of God to the knowledge of Him, and concomitant with that, there's an election to suffering. Look at these words from the Apostle John, the next words in your outline. Let's read this aloud together. I, John, your brother and companion in the suffering and kingdom and patient endurance that are ours in Jesus, was on the island of Patmos. 11 critical words. Would you underline with me, brother and companion in the suffering that are ours in Jesus. My relationship with God will include suffering. Now, there are five ways to think about this suffering, and we need to go quickly here. First of all, suffering can be, there are five, at least five that I thought of, five lenses on suffering in the Bible. And we'll look at these five quickly. First, suffering may be because of my own or someone else's sin. God sends suffering as chastisement because of sin. Numbers 12, when the cloud lifted from above the tent, there stood Miriam, leprous like snow. Aaron turned toward her and saw that she had leprosy. Then he said to Moses, "Please, my Lord, do not hold against us the sin we have so foolishly committed." And that suffering of leprosy on Miriam was chastisement for the sin that she and Aaron had in challenging Moses' authority. Second, another reason that God sends suffering is to rebuke me. Hebrews 12 teaches us about this. Let's read this aloud slowly together. "And you have forgotten that word of encouragement that addresses you as sons. My son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline, and do not lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines those he loves, and he punishes everyone he accepts as a son. Endure hardship as discipline. God is treating you as sons. For what son is not disciplined by his father?" Point here is that God is a loving father, and he's wanting to bring us all up. And just in the same way that our human fathers had to discipline us, so God also rebukes in paternal love. Thirdly, another reason for suffering in the Bible is to make me stronger. Paul talks about this in 2 Corinthians chapter 12. I'll read. "There was given me a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me. Three times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me, but he said to me," let's read this, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness." You know, each one of you and myself, in God's eyes, we're all like a great big chunk of ore, a great big hunk of rock and metal. And inside that rock, there's gold. And God wants to bring it out. But in order to get that gold out of that hunk of ore, he's going to have to take a hammer to the ore. And once he's taken the hammer to the ore and he's extracted the ore from the rock, then he's going to have to refine it. And the refining is going to mean heat. And he's going to put that ore in a crucible and heat it. And then the impurities will rise to the surface. And he'll scrape the impurities off the top. And then he'll heat it some more. And in order for gold to be purified, for gold to become useful, to be valuable to us, it has to be taken out of the rock and refined. And Scripture tells us that we're like that. That God in love has drawn us to himself, and he is preparing us to be with him forever. And he wants to see, when he looks in that molten metal, he wants to see the image of his son. And he turns up the heat, and he scrapes off the impurity, and he turns up the heat, until eventually on the surface of that ore, he sees the image of his son. He does it to make us stronger and better people. Fourthly, so that I and others will experience God's grace in deeper ways. Hate to spoil the story, but for many of you, it's the nth time around anyway. But at the end of Job, it's so encouraging. The end of Job, Job has the last dialogue, it's really more of a soliloquy, is when God speaks to Job. He says, "Job, you've been calling for me to get down and come and talk to you, and here I come." And all of a sudden, God speaks. And God lays it all out for Job. And Job says after that, he's undone. And he says, "My eyes had heard of you, but now my eye sees you." And at the end of the book of Job, as well as he knew God at the beginning, he knew him better at the end. Secondly, that's spiritually, there's benefit. But secondly, even materially, it says, look at the next verse, "After Job prayed for his friends, the Lord made him prosperous again and gave him twice as much as he had before." He gave him more children. He gave him material prosperity. And Job was better off at the end than he was at the beginning. Now, of course, there are questions. And I feel I feel sort of like a man standing on the beach in San Diego, getting ready to swim to Hawaii to talk to you about these questions of suffering and evil, because they're deep and they're great. And we can only scratch the surface today, but we'll be coming back over and over again to why, what all this says about God, and how can he be good and take Job's children and give them back again, but they're still not the same children. But next week, week after, there's a lot here. We can only get it sort of teed up today. But main point is, God allows us to experience suffering so that we'll experience his grace in deeper ways. And at the end of the book, Job knows God better, and he's materially more prosperous than at the beginning. And what this tells us is that Job, who in this book suffers and is in agony, but is faithful to God. And God will never be your debtor. You're not going to be more faithful to God than he's going to be faithful to you. For those who are faithful to God, no matter how hard it gets, at the end, you'll be so glad that you stuck with him. Fifth, another reason why we suffer is for reasons we will never know in this life. For reasons we will never know in this life. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13, "Now we see but a poor reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known." When we suffer, we don't always get answers. We don't know. Now, there are some times, to be sure, you'll look back in a period of suffering in your life. If we were to turn this open to testimony time, we'd go for hours here, and you know it. People say, "I suffered through this, and then God, in the midst of that, did that. And I suffered through this, and then God did something else." And many times we do see what God is doing. But the bottom line in 1 Corinthians 13, this particular text is saying, you're never going to know it all. So be willing to embrace the mystery. Be willing to accept the fact that God is God and we're not. And as Deuteronomy 29:29 says, the secret things belong to the Lord our God. But the things that are revealed belong to us and to our children forever. We're not going to know it all in this life. First lesson then, my relationship with God will include suffering. Secondly, God limits the attacks of Satan in the lives of his people. God limits the attacks of Satan in the lives of his people. Again, chapter 2, verse 6 is very important. Satan was about to hit Job as hard as a person can be hit and live. And God allows it, yes. But as powerful as Satan is, and as much as he is able to ruin the lives of every one of us, Satan answers to God. Let's read chapter 2, verse 6 together. "The Lord said to Satan, 'Very well then, he is in your hands, but you must spare his life.'" I only put verse 6, chapter 2, 6 in here, but let's look back. This is so important for many of you, personally, for me, for us. I want you to really get this. 2:6. God says, "He's in your hands, but spare his life." And then in chapter 1, verse 12, he says, "He's in your hands, but on the man himself don't lay a finger." So in the first iteration, he allows Job to go after all that Job has, children, possessions. You can go after all that he has, but don't touch him. And the second iteration, he says, "Okay, you can touch him, but spare his life." Both times, who's in charge? God. Who sets limits? God. And the point here is that God's people, even in suffering, are always under their loving Father's jealous eye. This is so neat. This is so encouraging. It's sort of like an NFL linebacker standing on the sidelines of a game. And his son, say, in fifth grade. And his son has a really kind of a mean and not very bright coach. And this coach just has a mean streak. And this NFL linebacker dad is watching this bozo of an elementary school coach be mean and unwise and cruel toward his son. At any time, that dad can step in. This whole situation is under his control. And the dad stands back for reasons of his own, if he does, or he either pulls the son or he doesn't. But if in my little analogy here, God is a father who watches what Satan is doing with his children, but Satan is on God's leash. And at any moment in the sufferings that you're going through, God can step in. Jesus knew that. When Jesus was arrested, he said, "Don't you know that I could at once call on my Father? And he would at once put 12 legions of angels at my authority?" Jesus knew that his Father was completely and fully in charge and could take this trouble away right now. So, I also want to insist, this is not just true for Job. This is true for you. Let's read this next verse. 1 Corinthians 10. Let's read together. "No temptation has seized you except what is common to man. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he will also provide a way out so that you can stand up under it." Would you underline those words in the end of the first line and the beginning of the second? "He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear." God knows what's coming down for you. God sees and he knows. And by the time it's gotten to you, God has given permission for that to come to you. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. So if it's there and if it's intense, which for many of us it is from time to time, then just know, God allowed this, and I may need to reach out to my Christian brothers and sisters. I may need to turn to God more. I may just need to, Psalm 62:8, go cry. Psalm 62:8, trust in Him at all times, O people. Pour out your heart before Him. God is a refuge for us. And so, if it comes, God's prepared you. You can take it. Whatever trial you're going through today, remember that God is watching. He wants you to turn your eyes from the trouble up to Him, to remember that He is there now and He's always going to be there until this thing is over. That's so important. That's not just Job. That's us. Number three. Well, first, we've seen that my relationship with God will include suffering. We've seen that God limits the attacks of Satan in the lives of His people. And lastly, we're going to look at this truth, that God's grace is enough for me today and always will be. God's grace is enough for me today, and it always will be. Job certainly had this attitude. That's what's so commendable about Job. In chapter 1, this is sort of an Old Testament way of saying it. "Naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I shall return." We even get a little reminder. We all came into the world about that size. And we weren't wearing much. But we came into this world, and we're all going to go out again. And so, think about your life. Remember, you were once like that. You were once crying, and your mom had to carry you out. And Job knew that about himself, and he knew, hey, I'm just a human being, and I'm trying to get through this life, and here we go. And sometimes the Lord gives good things, and that leads us to the next thing he says in chapter 2, verse 10, when he says, "You're talking like a foolish woman," what he means is he's not just sort of maliciously or vindictively assaulting her character, but he's saying folly is what the book of Proverbs and other wisdom literature describes as a way of thinking about life, a way of understanding the world that's counter to God and God's purposes. "The way you're thinking now, my wife, is not God's way. You're talking like a foolish woman." And then he says, "Shall we accept good from God, as Job had abundantly done, and not trouble? In all this, Job did not sin." So what's going on here? Job is the ultimate man who lost everything. He lost possessions. He lost his children. He lost his health. And the Bible teaches two truths that smash into each other in the book of Job. I hesitate to mention them both, because sometimes religious people fling these truths around in a way that is insensitive and hurtful. The only person who's really qualified to teach these truths to you and to me is Jesus Christ, because his life radiates the truthfulness and love that we need in order to accept these truths and accept them from God. So with that introduction, here are the two truths that Job teaches us. A good and just God inflicts suffering. A good and just God inflicts suffering, even on those he loves. Truth one. Truth two, humans, his people, can choose to accept that suffering in love. Now, you can say, you don't know what I'm going through, you don't know what happened to me, you don't know what happened to this, and I don't. So I don't want to just sort of slap you around with these truths. What I'm saying is Jesus can teach you these. Jesus is really the only one who can teach you this. But a good and just God does send suffering into the lives of his children. And then that same God calls you to accept that suffering in love. To know that he still loves you. And behind, you know, above the cloud and the storm, the sunshine of God's love is still coming at you. It's still there for you. So, Job is a great and shining example of that second truth, that we can choose to accept that suffering knowing that God's love is behind it. Job's world was in ruins. His health was destroyed. His friends who came to confront him couldn't recognize him. How does his heartbroken, body-inflamed man, how does he respond? He is loyal to his God. He doesn't deny his pain. He says, "Shall we accept good and not trouble?" He knows that what he's going through is excruciatingly bad and it's going to get worse. But he doesn't deny the ultimate source of his trouble either. "Shall we accept good and not trouble from God?" He knows it comes from God. His simple response to his wife is, "Hey, we take the good from him, we've got to take the trouble too." You know, a Christian has much greater reason to respond that way than Job did. Because of Jesus, we know that God and no one else can bring good out of evil. Without denying that that evil is horrific, we know that we can often look back on evil and see that it actually served good purposes. Jesus' cross, the greatest of all evils that ever was, with its treachery against and its cruel murder of the beloved Son of God, Jesus' cross became an emblem of God's justice. Sin will be dealt with. And God's forgiveness, I take it for you. His renewal to human beings from every nation. Here's a practical way that a Christian reflecting on both the story of Job and the cross of Jesus can respond to suffering. A modern way to say with Job, "Naked I came, naked I go, blessed be the name of the Lord. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble?" Another way to say this is what I said before. God's grace is enough for me right now. And it always will be. That's how a Christian follows Job. When we experience excruciating suffering, the loss of a marriage, the loss of a loved one in death, final confirmation that the illness is terminal, it changes the way we see everything. The sun still shines, and the people around you are rushing on their schedules. The traffic is there on 206 and 287. The same things are on TV. But we wonder, what's the point? Life is hollow. Our suffering comes as a surprise. No matter how hard we work, we're not in control. We don't know the future. We don't understand. In the face of our vulnerability and our mortality, the things that seem so strong are shown to be so weak. Money, status, power. Where is that going to get you as you stand at the grave of the one you love? When you realize, some of you, that in middle age you will never be married again. That your illness is going to win. Your IRA going to help you then? Your position? Your standing in the community? In 100 years, every one of us is going to be gone. So what's the point? What's the meaning in this life? Is there any meaning? Is there any point? Jesus helps us to see that in suffering and death, because He is the Son of God, was killed and came back. He taught that life is not just something natural, that not life is not something accidental that just happens. Life is a miracle. Life is a gift. When you're truly in love and you hold the warm body of someone you love in your arms, when you lift a small child, fragile and cuddling, against your chest, when you're at the deathbed of a friend or a dearly loved family member, at those times you get it right. Life is a gift, and life is God's miracle. So we need to be thankful for life and not take a day for granted. It comes from God, however long it is. He gives it, and the wise way to live is to give it back, to live it His way. Make use of the days God gives you. Love your family. Love your friends. Do your best at your job. Value the relationships God's given you. Write that letter today. Make that phone call you've been meaning to make. You're not in control of this life, and you never will be. Don't try. Don't worry. Take one day at a time. Give each day back to God. Even as we grieve for the job that's lost, the marriage that's gone, the disease that's destroying, the loved one who's gone, trust God every day. If we try to solve all the problems and worries of the future, we'll find that obviously we can't. There will be hard days ahead, sad days, but God gives us the strength one day at a time. Don't worry about tomorrow, Jesus said, because tomorrow will take care of itself. God's grace is enough for us today, and it always will be. As we conclude today, we're about to receive tithes and offerings. If you're a guest today, don't feel pressure to give. We would like to get your welcome card so we can respond to you and greet you, but we expect nothing more. If you're not a Christian and you're here today, your being here today is no accident. God brought you here to tell you that your troubles are never ultimate. God is ultimate. Trouble is not ultimate. I said at the beginning, suffering is one of the unhappy realities of this life, and no reasonable person is ever going to deny that. But in a world where suffering is unavoidable, God's grace is available. Where suffering is unavoidable, God's grace is available. I don't live up to my own standards, much less God's. I fall short, and so do you. But if we turn to God and admit our sin, He will forgive us, and He'll put His Spirit inside us to strengthen us to live the way we should. We do have to suffer. We don't have to suffer alone. We do have to suffer. We don't have to suffer without hope. This is good news, and it's just as real today as when Job walked the earth maybe 3,000 years ago. Jesus is calling to you today, come to me. Come to Him. During these next moments, ask yourself, how do these truths touch my life? How do these truths touch my suffering? How can I know God as Job did? Think then, as the music plays and as the offering is taken, it's just a fact. Your relationship with God will include suffering, number one. God limits the attacks of Satan in your life, number two. And number three, God's grace is enough for you today, and it always will be. Let's lift our hearts and our gifts the Lord.